Information, please. Presented each week at this time by Canada Dry, famous the world over for its fine beverages. Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts and enjoy a cool, refreshing glass of ginger ale. Every week at this time, Canada Dry presents Information, Please. We set up four talking encyclopedias, and you send us the toughest stumpers you can think of. You may submit from one to three original questions. For every question our quartet fails to answer, the sender gets $10 with the compliments of Canada Dry. For every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $5. So you can make $15 if our experts miss out, which they occasionally do. Our editorial staff may reword your question a trifle. Don't worry about it. Whenever there is a duplication of questions, Information Please uses the one that was submitted first. All questions become the property of Information Please and should be addressed to Canada Dry, 1 Pershing Square, New York City. And now may I present our master of ceremonies, Mr. Clifton Fadiman, literary critic of the New Yorker magazine. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, we should like to emphasize again the fact that Information Please is unrehearsed and unpremeditated. We always like to repeat this for the benefit of members of the I Don't Believe in Santa Claus Club. Now, opposite me this evening at a long table are seated John Kieran, our omniscient sports expert, Franklin P. Adams, conductor of the Conning Tower, Rex Stout, creator of the famous Nero Wolf Mysteries, and as our special guest of honor, Wilfred Funk, publisher, lexicographer, and author of many books of light verse. Now remember, for each question that's missed by these gentlemen, Canada Dry rings up $10. And that's paid out to the sender, plus $5 for the use of the question. All right, suppose we start with an inquiry sent in by Frank D. Richardson of the city. Now, you gentlemen, of course, all know your presidents very well, I assume. And Mr. Stout, at least, who has a most beautifully tended beard and mustache, should know something about beards and mustaches. I'm going to ask you to put your knowledge of hirsute adornment together with your knowledge of the presidents of the United States and name for me the last three presidents who had mustaches when they were in office. I mean, the presidents were in office, not the mustaches. The last three presidents who had mustaches when they were in office. Mr. Stout, the possessor of a very fine mustache, beautiful one.
Theodore Roosevelt.
Grover Cleveland is two.
Chester A. Arthur.
The last three presidents. Chester A. Arthur, I'm afraid, would be wrong. The last three. Mr. Adams?
William Howard Taft.
Yes, he had a beautiful one. Very fine, generous mustache. Well, I think I'll let that go. Between the two of them, they got the three presidents with mustaches. Mr. Stout, you're probably the only one who has any right to answer this query. Do you mind if I put a political question to you?
I'd like it.
Do you think we'll ever again have a president with a full beard and mustache, or do you think those days are gone forever?
With a mustache or with both, Mr. President?
With both. The same sort of thing that you have.
I'm sorry, I don't think I'll have time to try for the office.
Well, Mr. Stout is out of the running. The next question from Claire W. Callahan of Pottstown, Pennsylvania, is this. I'm going to read some quotations, four of them. And each of these quotations, they're pretty well known, is in the form of a question. Now, the answers are given in the lines that immediately follow these quotations. And you're to give me those answers. In other words, just finish the quotation. The first question is, how many hairs will make a wig? How many hairs will make a wig? Ever hear that line when you were children? Mr. Adams.
You mean what precedes it?
No, what follows it? The next line or lines answers that question. How many hairs will make a wig?
24, that's enough.
Good. Very good, Mr. Adams. And remember the next line that goes on after that? 24.
Give the poor barber a pinch of snuff.
Yes, don't be so pathetic about it. No poor, just give the barber a pinch of snuff. That's fine. And where are those lines from, Mr. Adams, do you know?
Oh, probably Mother Goose.
Mother Goose, yes. I think they're generally ascribed to that lady. Now, the next question. When shall we three meet again in thunder, lightning, or in rain? Do those lines awaken any response in those giant brains of yours, gentlemen? Mr. Kieran, your giant brain?
No, they're the witches in Macbeth.
They are.
Trying to think up what...
Just go through the whole play until you come to those lines, Mr. Kieran. Mr. Adams?
Double, double... toil and trouble.
That would not be the answer to the question. That's a very good quotation from Macbeth. And I'm glad to get it. But it doesn't answer the question. When shall we three meet again in thunder, lightning, or in rain? It goes on. When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won. Remember now, Mr. Kieran, Mr. Adams, Mr. Funk, Mr. Stout? They're all smiling. They all remember it. Sorry, we have to count that wrong. Now, we have to get 3 out of 4 on these, so we have to get the next 2 quite correct. The next one's very easy. I don't think I'll even give you the line. I'll whistle it for you instead. How's that?
Mr.
Funk.
Where has somebody gone?
Who?
That's
the precise in this program. Mr. Adams?
My Highland laddie.
Yes, but what's the answer to the question? The line is, oh, where and oh, where does your Highland laddie dwell? And the answer is, Mr. Stout?
No, I'm using the second stanza. Where and oh, where is your Highland laddie gone? He's gone to fight the foe for King George upon the throne.
That will do very well. That will do very well. The answer to the first stanza question, oh, where and oh, where does your Highland laddie dwell, is he dwells in merry Scotland at the sign of the Blue Bell. But your answer is perfectly correct, Mr. Stout. And who wrote the song?
Wasn't Robert Burns.
Very well-known writer. Very well-known. Find him in any index. Mr.
Anon.
Anon, yes. Oh, Joe Anon. That's right.
You know the answers.
I pulled that out of the clouds.
Pretty good, wasn't it? Now, the last quotation in the form of a question. Goodness me. Why, what was that? Mr. Adams?
Silent B, it was the cat.
Right, correct. And what's the quotation from?
H.M.S. Pinafore.
H.M.S. Pinafore by Gilbert and Sullivan, of course. You could go on with that quotation if I dared you, couldn't you, Mr. Adams?
No, I'm anything but clever. I could keep that up forever.
They got 3 out of 4. Good enough. Haven't been able to stump them yet. I'm going to switch you from poetry now to vegetables and fruits and things of that sort. Mr. A. Hill of San Francisco tells us the following fruits are all hybrids. Of course, you all know what a hybrid is. Now, what fruits were crossed or grafted to produce them? The 3 fruits are the plumcot, the tangelo, and the loganberry. Now, the first, the plumcot, was made from what other fruits, Mr. Stout?
A plum and an apricot.
A plum and an apricot. Of course, you might have gotten that just from the sound. Mr. Funk, you'd admit that would be a pretty easy one.
I was just raising my hand.
By the way, I'm sorry, Mr. Funk.
Not a guess.
That is in your dictionary, the plumcot?
I can't tell you that, honestly.
All right, we're going to look it up. The next one is the tangelo. T-A-N-G-E-L-O, the tangelo. A fruit, I must say, I have never heard of. Mr. Kieran, want to guess?
Nobody wants it. I'd say it's a cross between a tangerine and a...
And jello. I beg pardon?
Tangerine and a lemon.
No, I'm sorry. What made you think it was a lemon?
Well, on account of that...
Yellow?
The labial.
Yeah. You'd have to reverse the spelling of lemon a little to get that word out of it. No, it was produced by crossing a tangerine with a grapefruit, any grapefruit that didn't object to it. The name is derived from tangerine plus pomelo. Pomelo, P-O-M-E-L-O, they tell me, is another name for grapefruit. Did you know that, Mr. Kieran?
No, but shaddock is.
That's good. That's good. But I don't see what you could do with shaddock if you wanted to cross it with a tangerine verbally.
I don't think I'd like it. It sounds too complicated.
It does sound too complex, Mr. Funk, doesn't it? Sorry, I have to count you wrong on that, Mr. Kieran. Now, the loganberry was produced from what fruits, the loganberry? Mr. Kieran.
That was one of Burbank's creation creations, and it created an awful row in the berry world about 25 years ago.
Having the slightest doubt.
Question whether it was really helpful or not. I've forgotten who won the Great War, but...
I'm delighted to get that information, but would you give me the answer to the question, Mr. Kieran?
No.
Well, that's 100% so far. The loganberry, gentlemen, is produced from a graft of the trailing blackberry bush and the red raspberry bush. Of course, we all should have known that. And why was it named loganberry? Does any of you know?
Obviously,
Mr. Stout?
Because Mr. Logan did the crossing.
It was first developed on the lands of Judge Logan of Santa Cruz, California. Now, we were supposed to get 2 out of 3 on that. We got only 1 out of 3. Gentlemen, you knew only the plumcot. I'm surprised at you. Mr. Hill of San Francisco will get $10, courtesy of Canada Dry. By curious coincidence, the next question I notice comes to us from Burbank, California. And it comes from the son of the late Ring Lardner, from Ring Lardner, Jr. And there are three questions here about Sherlock Holmes. That's your master's voice, Mr. Stout. And let's see whether you know anything about the detective stories of Sherlock Holmes. What man did Sherlock Holmes acknowledge as his superior in observation and deduction? I think Mr. Stout had his hand up first. Mr. Heron had his hand
Moriarty.
Up
Moriarty.
I beg pardon?
Sherlock Holmes acknowledged Professor Moriarty as his superior, but subsequent to that, he acknowledged that his brother was his superior in deduction.
Which one would you like to let stand as your answer?
Well, I think Moriarty, because Moriarty is more dramatic, but when you added the words deduction, I guess that confined it to his brother. I don't know that he ever did admit that Moriarty could deduce better than he could.
I believe that it was his brother.
Yeah.
His name was what, Mr. Stout?
Began with M.
Yes, Mycroft. Did you know that, Mr. Kieran?
I knew his brother, but I would not remember his name.
No, well, I don't think any of us would.
You never forget a face, do you?
No.
Actually, Mr. Stout, does Mycroft Holmes ever appear in any of the stories?
Yes, in one of them.
Does he?
Sherlock goes to consult him on one of his cases.
And you actually are introduced to him?
At his club, of course, since he's in London.
I didn't remember that. Very well. One right out of three questions about Sherlock Holmes. Now, what woman successfully outwitted Sherlock Holmes? Mr. Kieran.
A queen of a foreign country who came to him as a client and outwitted him, and all he got out of it, I believe, was her autograph photograph when the case was over.
Would that be right, Mr. Stout?
Wrong.
I'm going to ask Mr. Stout to be the umpire on this.
It was the while I'm friend and to be wife of a continental king.
You wouldn't like to give me the name.
She was not, had not been, and I think never was going to be a queen.
You've got the
finest... Her name was, I think, Irene.
Irene, yes, and her last name?
Sorry.
That's all right. Irene's good enough. We always like to call them by their first names on this program. Irene Adler, and the story was what? Called what? Do you remember, Mr. Stout?
It was about the letter. Scandal in Bohemia.
A Scandal in Bohemia, yes. That's the correct response, I think, Mr. Kieran. Now, your answer may be correct, but
no,
I should...
No, that's the story, but I just thought that I'm easily impressionable, and I thought she was a queen. You know?
Well, do you have that same experience with most of the ladies you meet around town, Mr. Kieran? Now, gentlemen, one more question about Sherlock Holmes, sent in by Mr. Lardner. What learned criminal in the Holmes stories wrote a treatise on the binomial theorem? I shall not ask you to explain the binomial theorem. Merely name the criminal. Merely name the criminal. I think we've even baffled the factually unbafflable Mr. Stout. The answer is one of your first responses, Mr. Stout, Professor Moriarty.
He did that too.
Yes, he did that too.
Elementary, my dear Stout.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Should have known that, I suppose. Actually, we got one wrong. We're supposed to get two out of three. We've just got by the skin of our teeth. Mr. Stout, speaking of the Holmes stories and the binomial theorems and such like, tell me, why is there so much scholarship in modern detective stories? I noticed that you and your colleagues have become extremely learned during the last 10 years, and unless you have a full knowledge of Egyptology and anthropology and so forth, it's practically impossible to read you, Phil.
Well, I presume it's because no one is really competent to write a good detective story except a very erudite and able person, and naturally the things they know come into the story.
That was Mr. Stout's thing. I'm very glad to get that modest appraisal, Mr. Stout. Now, from Buffalo, New York, from Mr. Charles Hall, comes a question which tests your knowledge of classical mythology. Now, if a modern community were peopled by gods or humans from classical mythology, who would turn up in the following roles and why? The first would be an arms manufacturer, a manufacturer of weapons. Mr. Funk.
Mars, I presume.
Mars, why would you say that?
For war?
Yes, it would be a fair response, but I think more specifically, Mr. Adams?
Vulcan.
Vulcan. Why Vulcan?
But he was a blacksmith.
He was a blacksmith. Yeah, he made weapons for the gods. That was his job. Remember, he made the famous Shield of Achilles, I think. Will that be right, Mr. Kieran?
Yes, he made all the shields, including the Aegis of Minerva. And he also made the shield for Mars and his sword.
Yes, that's the last time I give any information.
Yeah.
Mr. Kieran, always cap it with two more pieces of information. Now, if a Western Union messenger, let's make that Western Union or Postal Telegraph, turned up. They all have their hands up. Mr. Punk, what classical...
Would it be Mercury character? By some chance?
Yes, Mercury, unquestionably, who acted as messenger for the gods. And how did Mercury, the messenger of that period, travel? On a bicycle, Mr. Punk? How did he get around?
I thought it was on wings.
Yes, and where do you have them attached?
On his ankles.
On his ankles. We like to get you very precise on these matters, Mr. Punk, if you don't mind.
Very embarrassing.
You're coming along nicely, though. Now, suppose... somebody turned up as a ferry boat captain. What character would that be? Mr. Adams.
Charon. C-H-A-R-O-N.
Yes, that's mispronounced slightly, but otherwise...
That's
very
what
good
I was
response.
Afraid of.
Yeah. I think it's Charon, isn't it?
Mr. Punk?
Isn't it Charon?
Well, don't ask me. You're a lexicographer.
Well, have you a dictionary here?
Not one. No. We never have any books of reference. Charon is correct. Thank you, Mr. Adams and Mr. Punk. A ferryman at the Styx who bore the dead... across the river Styx to Hades. Now, if the role were the role of a waitress, what character would that be? Mr. Kieran.
Hebe.
Hebe.
Cupbearer to the gods.
Cupbearer to the gods. 4 out of 4. Pretty good. The next question from Mrs. W.G. Wilcox of Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's a very nice one. Now, listen carefully, gentlemen. If a schoolmaster had a date with an alewife and a sailor's choice, where would they be likely to meet? I'll repeat that. If a schoolmaster... had a date with an alewife, A-L-E-W-I-F-E, and a sailor's choice, where would the three of them be likely to meet? Sounds as if this particular schoolmaster could teach us a thing or two. Mr. Kira.
I think they're all fishes.
They are all fishes, that's right. Would you like to explain what each of them is?
I don't know. An alewife is a small fish, edible fish that runs up the New England stream.
It's just barely edible, being a herring, Mr. Kira.
It's a small herring.
Yes. That's one of the best things about it. Alewife belongs to the herring family. Schoolmaster would be what sort of fish?
I really don't know them.
Do you want me to tell you?
Yes,
be a new experience for me. It's a snapper. And I believe found...
It's a young bluefish. A snapper is.
All right. I'm not going to tell you anything more, Mr. Kieran. That's the last time, absolutely. And a sailor's choice would be what sort of fish? Well, I believe it's used for various fishes, a porgy, a pigfish, a pinfish, and also a grunt, whatever a grunt is. What is a grunt, Mr. Kieran?
It's an odd-looking fish that makes a sort of squawky, grunty noise when you catch it, or lift it out of the water, I mean.
And you actually have hearing acquaintance with it, with a grunt?
Yes, I fish by ear.
Very well. We check up our disbursements, and we find that Canada Dry has paid out $10. Our highly touted experts knew most of the answers, but not quite all of them. And while they're touting themselves still higher, Mr. Milton Cross has a few words to say.
Thank you, Mr. Fadiman. Information, please, presented each week at this time by Canada Dry, famous the world over for its fine beverages. Now, don't be alarmed, Mr. Fadiman. I haven't lost my place. The repetition of our opening speech was merely to emphasize that word beverages. For in addition to ginger ale and sparkling water... Canada Dry produces a wide assortment of popular beverages, and each bottle bears the familiar Canada Dry label. Everyone seems to appreciate the exceedingly great care exercised by Canada Dry. Constant testing of all ingredients maintains our high standard of quality. All water used in Canada Dry beverages is filtered and purified many times before it is carbonated, and Canada Dry's own pinpoint carbonation, a carefully developed and scientific process, points up the delicious flavors and imparts an exhilarating sparkle. Because of all this diligence and care, the Canada Dry label has become a symbol of high standards. And that's why today more people than ever before are saying, Canada Dry, please.
Most enlightening, Mr. Cross. And as a point of information, your brief speech was timed in 64 seconds. Now, shall we go on to a question that comes to us from Raleigh, North Carolina, from Miss Foy Ingram. Miss Ingram wants you, gentlemen, to give 4 instances in fiction or poetry in which a picture is vital to the plot. The picture plays an important part in the plot. Mr. Kieran had his hand up first.
The Merchant of Venice. The picture of Portia is on the casket that Bassanio picks at last and wins Portia as his bride.
That's quite correct. That casket was made of what metal?
Lead. Base lead.
Base lead. Ordinary lead. That's one. Now, Mr. Funk, you had your hand up.
Am I wrong in one about Robert Browning's about the Duchess?
You're quite right. It was a picture. Yes. And what is the title of the poem by Robert Browning, Mr. Funk?
It has Duchess in it.
I forget
the exact title.
Mr. Kieran?
Well, I was going to say that the opening is, "That's my last Duchess painted on the wall. I call that piece a wonder now," and so forth.
Yes, I'm sure you could go on with it. Well, the poem is simply called, Mr. Stout. My Last Duchess.
My Last Duchess.
That's two. Very good, Mr. Funk. Mr. Adams.
The picture that was turned toward the wall.
What is that, Mr.
That
Adams?
Is a song. Popular song.
Would you like me to allow a popular song in as poetry this evening?
Sure.
All right.
Poetry.
I'm being bluffed into this, but I'll allow it.
There's a name that's never spoken.
Go ahead. What rhymes with spoken?
There's a mother's heart that's broken.
That's nice.
There is just another missing from the old home, that is all.
That's all I can stand, Mr. Adams. Stop. Very good. That's three. Mr. Stout.
Must it be a poem?
No, it could be a novel.
The picture of Dorian Gray.
Yes, very good. Who wrote it?
Oscar Wilde, yes. Or The Face on the Barroom Floor.
Yes, that would be a very good one. And if I may be permitted to name a favorite work of art of mine that's neither fiction or poetry, I think there was a moving picture some years ago that the Marx Brothers starred in called Animal Crackers. And wasn't there a picture, Mrs. Rittenhouse's picture, which was stolen? And one of the Marx Brothers had to find the picture. I remember that the picture was very vital to the plot, although the plot wasn't very vital to that particular picture.
There's another song called "A Picture No Artist Can Paint."
Who wrote the song?
I don't know.
All right, that's good enough. We have six pictures at least. Done yourself proud, gentlemen, on that question. The next one, from D. Miller of Chicago, is a question testing your knowledge of the meanings of words. I want you to give the original meanings of the following words by tracing them back to their sources in any language that's handy to you. The first word is a very simple one that we use very constantly. Melancholy. Melancholy. What's the original meaning of it, melancholy? Mr. Kieran?
It comes from the Greek, melon. That means black.
Yep.
And the collie part of it, I think, goes back to thoughts or disposition of some kind.
You're on the right track, but I think that cole means a secretion of the bile.
That's right.
A black secretion. It was thought that people who had a... go ahead with it, Mr. Kieran. You want to explain that to us?
That they turned black, with a depressing look on them, and that they had depressing thoughts and were depressed from something that made them, in this state, melancholy.
That's right. Those who had an excess of black bile were thought to be of that nature, melancholy or sad nature. That's quite correct. Now, a word that's even simpler, the word silly, which we use constantly. The word silly means what originally? Silly.
I'm having a busman's holiday.
Mr. Funk, go ahead.
No.
Enjoy yourself. That's in your dictionary,
I know,
Mr. Funk. The word silly goes back to the Anglo-Saxon Zelig, S-O-E-L-I-G, which is, of course, related to the German Selig, S-E-L-I-G, means what?
Happy.
Yes, Mr. Kieran, happy or prosperous or good or blessed. How a word originally meaning good or blessed now becomes silly, I don't know. Mr. Funk, how do words change that way?
The silly are the only ones who are good, aren't they, Mr. Funk?
That's a moral remark which I should take to heart.
Well, they change by common usage. People do distort them and change them.
Yes, they do. And
you
funny
have to
thing
accept
is,
the common usage.
It's a funny thing, Mr. Funk, isn't it, that words tend to degrade themselves in meaning. And as a word which once had a rather nice meaning tends after a while to have a, what you fellows call a pejorative meaning or... a bad meaning.
Well, you've topped me on that word, but sometimes...
you look that up.
Sometimes they come from the gas house district and cross the tracks and come up also to Park Avenue from the slums.
Thank you for tracing that career for us.
My theory, Mr. Fadlin, is not entirely facetious. A good poet said, "Be good, dear child, and let who will be clever."
Yes, think there's anything in it?
It means that the good child was a silly one, I suppose.
Yes, but I think she only made out well in that poem. We have melancholy and silly traced for us. Now, the last word, we haven't melancholy and silly traced for us, rather. I've traced silly for you. The last word is pecuniary. Pecuniary. Mr. Adams? Pecuniary? It means what, Mr. Adams? Mr. Kieran.
From the herd.
Pecuniary
Mr. Kieran can help us out a little.
Pecuniary was the Latin word for money.
Yes, but what's the original meaning? What's the original meaning of the word?
Well, the original meaning traces back to the fact that in the old days, I believe that money, wealth was in cattle and other such forms.
What's the word cattle got to do with it, with the word pecuniary?
Well, I think that it means beef or something on the hoof. Pecus.
The herd.
Yes, pecus means a herd, as Mr. Adams says, or cattle. That's quite right. We got 2 out of 3 on that one. We were supposed to get 3 out of 3 to satisfy Mr. Miller, so we'll send $10, courtesy of Canada Dry, to him. Let's see, will we have time for another question? I'm afraid not. A final checkup reveals that Canada Dry has lost a total of $20. Now, Mr. Milton Cross wants a brief word, and then I'll be back with news of next week's guests.
That famous British custom, time out in the afternoon for refreshments, is almost as old as the Empire. For centuries, it has been regarded as merely social. But now we know, by scientific experiments on people doing all sorts of work and play, that mid-afternoon refreshments relax tired minds and bodies, furnish new energy with which to carry on. It has occurred to me that it's a custom we could well profit by. So why not take time out on these afternoons? Relax for a while with a cool, sparkling glass of Canada Dry ginger ale. For ginger ale is always refreshing, always thirst-quenching, a quick energy builder, ideal for such occasions. And Canada Dry is the world's finest, the champagne of ginger ales. Now here's a special tip to mothers. You can make a delicious ginger ale ice cream soda by simply putting a generous scoop of vanilla ice cream in a glass and adding Canada Dry. Your children will love it.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. And Mr. Wilfred Funk and Mr. Rex Stout, won't you please accept Canada Dry's thanks for joining the fun this evening, and may I add, doing so well. Now, next week, our invaluable trio will be on hand, Mr. Oscar Levant, Mr. John Kieran, and Mr. Franklin P. Adams. And our guest of honor will be that noted news commentator, journalist, and author, Mr. Raymond Graham Swing. To our listeners, we say, please send your questions along. Make them as hard as you wish. And if you have a stumper to stump our board of experts, we'll be most glad to have it. There are $5 in it for you if we use your question, and another $10 if we fail to answer it correctly. So you can win $15 in all. Send your letters with questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, 1 Pershing Square, New York City.
Among the host of Canada Dry beverages, you are bound to enjoy these summer favorites. Canada Dry Tom Collins Mixer and Canada Dry Lime Ricky, both made with a genuine fruit base and the finest ingredients. No preservatives or artificial flavoring. So for cooling, tall drinks with a lemon flavor, order Canada Dry's Tom Collins Mixer. For a lime flavor, insist on Canada Dry Lime Ricky. The family size is economical, costing only 15 cents. This is Milton Cross saying good night, all.